All right. It's good to see everyone here. I'm so grateful to be here to hang out with you all. I hope you guys are all having a great morning, a good July, good summer. It's pretty cool that we get to connect and be together. I know! It's pretty cool. Is this being in front of me? Okay. All right. I'm just gonna stay like this for now. Just like the Buddha, I'll hold up a single rose and you can all smile in instant recognition. All right. So, as I was saying, I think it's really cool that we get to come together and connect and just share. And this good stuff we call the Dharma. I'm really happy to be here and happy to see so many people I really treasure and who inspire me and support me just by showing up and being themselves. And I know I haven't had a chance to meet all of you, but I certainly hope to one day, and hopefully we can become friends. There's a new movie out right now that some of you may have seen about Mr. Rogers. Has anybody seen it? What's the title of it? It's Won't You Be My Neighbor? I haven't seen it yet, but I've been reflecting lately on a Mr. Rogers figure from a different time, Aesop of Aesop's Fables. When I was a kid, I really loved Aesop's Fables. Even going back to a toddler, I can remember this book I had and how vivid the illustrations were to me. You know, in Aesop's stories, everything is alive. Everything is imbued with a life force. If it's people, if it's animals, or even if it's inanimate objects. Like great stories, I think Aesop's fables have resonated for over 2,500 years for good reason. They're simple, they're direct, and they also hold up a mirror. They hold up a mirror and help us better understand what's going on inside of us, regardless if we're young or regardless if we're old. This is the first century Common Era Roman philosopher Apollonius talking about Aesop's fables. Like those who dined well off the plainest dishes, Aesop made use of humble incidents to teach great truths. I use that line for my Amazon review of Kim's new book, by the way. Though there are questions of Aesop's historicity, more people do agree that Aesop was a living person, lived about 2,500 years ago, 500 BCE. So that's kind of interesting because he's contemporary with a lot of other big Axial Age figures that we know of, like the Buddha, Lao Tzu, Confucius, the pre-Socratic Greek philosopher, the Hebrew prophet. Interestingly, Aesop's stories weren't intended for children when they were first written. Most of them are satirical comments on the political, social, religious issues of the day, and it really wasn't until the Middle Ages that they became associated with children's literature. Aesop most likely didn't write all the stories. There's similar idioms, imagery found in stories that go back 1,000 years to ancient Sumer. There's similarities and analogies to stories that go as far west as Western Africa and far east as India, including similarities to stories found in the Jataka Tales, which is a collection of Pali language stories about the previous lives of the Buddha. But you can see his stories, there's something deeply resonant about them. Something connects directly to this experience that we call being human and we call being alive. So what I want to do this morning is unpack 3 of Aesop's fables and take a look at how their messages can support us on our journey as bodhisattvas. I want to start with the North Wind and the Sun and talk about how we begin on the Bodhisattva path by just returning to right here, regardless of what we might be facing, regardless of what might be going on in this monkey mind of ours. I want to talk about the story, The Hart and the Hunter, to talk about stirring awake Bodhicitta, this Bodhisattva heart of ours. And then I want to talk about a story that Tim, again, talks a lot about, The Tortoise and the Hare. Talk about realizing our Bodhisattva vows. But before I go further, just for folks who might not know that term, bodhisattva, though I know a lot of folks in this room are familiar with it, I do want to provide a definition. So bodhisattvas are thought to be these enlightened beings who have the opportunity to go off into nirvana, but rather instead come right back here. They come back here. And they make this vow to save all beings and help all beings achieve enlightenment before they themselves then go on to nirvana. For me, bodhisattva vows certainly do exist on the realm of the archetypal and the realm of the mythological, but they're also really concrete and real to me. And the idea of the bodhisattva is very concrete and real to me for two simple reasons. One, in Buddhist teachings, we live in this vast, vast interconnected universe where we all share these deep connections that we can never know intellectually, but we can live every moment in our lives. So in that sense, we can't help but do this practice to benefit all beings. We don't have any other choice. By just the nature of doing it, we're impacting the world in ways that we'll never, ever fully know. Equally important, just like a bodhisattva during our Zazen practice, aren't we always going off? You know, I feel like I'm constantly chasing after thoughts, chasing after emotions, chasing after stories, chasing after physical sensations. And in response, our practice teaches us to come back to right here, just like the bodhisattva, come back to this moment, this experience, this connection, this relationship, and this life. All right, so with that, I will start with our first story, which is The North Wind and the Sun. This wasn't a story that I was familiar with until I started digging into different Aesop's fables, but I really like it. I think it has a really neat the way it illustrates ways that we can meet our mind in our Zazen practice. So if I just show hands, does anybody know The North Wind and the Sun? There you go, Peter! Love it! So The North Wind and the Sun... The North Wind and the Sun are hanging out one day and they decide to have a competition. They decide to compete and decide to compete to see who can make this traveler coming down the path remove his cloak. So the North Wind begins, and what does he do to get that traveler to remove his cloak? He starts blowing hard, blows hard, blows hard, and that traveler, in response, just grabs a hold of his cloak and grabs a hold of it tighter and tighter and tighter. Much like me when I was fooling around with this thing, right? The more I fool around with it, just the more used it got. So, when it's the sun's turn, so what does the sun do? The sun, in response, he just lets his rays fall on the man. Just gently shines on the man. And as the air temperature warms with each step, the man just simply removes his cloak. My wife and I were kayaking last summer, and I dropped my glasses in the water. And it was about midway between my ankle and my knee. And as I looked in the water, I saw my glasses just resting there in the sand, in the mud. And as soon as I reached down into that water, it just immediately became this swirl of activity that kicked up mud and I kicked up sand, and that water just became murky and dark. And the more I struggled, the more I tried to grab and reach and dig for my glasses, the murkier and the murkier the water got. And it wasn't until I just chilled out. I just stood still. I just waited. But that sand and that mud and that murkiness just settled down on its own and rested on the bottom of that shore, and I could see well enough to retrieve my glasses. And I think our Zazen can feel like that too. I know mine can feel like that sometimes. Where I can feel like a pugilist with this mind of mine, bobbing and weaving as it's going and going and going. And the more I just want it to give me a break, the more I just want it to stop, the more I just want it to find some semblance of stillness, some semblance of quiet. It just goes and goes and goes. And in those times, I can feel like that north wind. I can feel like that north wind trying to blow hard on this mind of mine, and only to have my mind grab a hold of that cloak tighter and tighter. So maybe we can do something different. Maybe we can do something different and meet this mind of ours like that warm sun. Meet this mind of ours and just let the rays fall upon it. Just be present to it. Just be with it. Meet each thought, each story, each sensation, each emotion with a sense of gentleness and with a sense of non-judgment. Gentleness and non-judgment are for me just two fundamental techniques that we can use to help just be present and open to this experience as it comes and goes. We can imagine this mind of ours is like horses at play in a wild open field. And if you think of horses at play in a wild open field, what do they need? They need a lot of space. They need a lot of space. If we try to control those horses, get them in a pen, corral them together, often they just get upset. They kick, they neigh, they bite. So we can just trust that, let those fence posts down, let that corral fall to the ground, and just let those horses be. Give them some space. Just rest in that wide open valley, just like we can rest in this wide open mind of ours. Rest in that warm sun. Rest in that feeling of being gentle, that feeling of being non-judgmental. And we can trust this mind will return to stillness. Stillness is the original nature of all things. It underlines each moment of our lives. Stillness is there for us. This heart of ours, it's already awake. Our Buddha nature, our inherent Buddha nature is already here. That's why Katagiri Roshi used to say, nothing extra. Because nothing extra is needed. It's here already, waiting for us, calling us out, like kids playing on the front lawn when we were ourselves a kid, calling us out, saying, hey, come on out, come play with us, come on. So the stillness and spaciousness is here when times when we feel like the warm sun, that's really easy to see. But it's also here. The same stillness and spaciousness is also here during those times when we feel like the north wind. During those times, stillness and spaciousness is here too. This is a great story from The Hidden Lamp, stories from 25 centuries of awakened women. The convent of Tokeji had a great mirror. The founding abbess, Kakuzan Shido, would meditate before it to see into her true nature. Later generations of nuns would practice zazen in front of that same mirror, concentrating on the same questions. Where is a single feeling, a single thought, in the mirror at which to gaze? Each abbess of Tokeji wrote a verse in response to the mirror practice. The following verse was composed by the fifth abbess, Princess Yodo. Heart unclouded, heart clouded, standing or falling, it is still the same body. I'll read that one more time. Heart unclouded, heart clouded, it is still the same body. This moment here is our lives unfolding in front of us, regardless of what might be coming up for us. Regardless if this heart is clouded or unclouded, our body, our being is still the same. The same bevy of physical sensations, the same emotions, the same thoughts, and the same stories. But just as the nuns of Tokeji, we can stay right here. Stay in this moment. Rest in that bright sun. Return, just as bodhisattvas, return right back here. And again, just as there's times when we can be with this moment here in our zazen practice and that bright sun, as I said earlier, we can be with it in the north wind too. We don't need to control this mind of ours, even when it is the north wind mind. It's just as Natalie Goldberg wrote when she said, let yourself live in something that is already rightfully yours, your own wild mind. So we can just meet this north wind mind. We can have it over as a guest. We don't need to invite in for tea. We can just say, I see you there, north wind mind, my friend. I can be with you right now, north wind mind, my friend. No need to grab a hold of your cloak tightly. I can stay with you and be with you when it's time for you to come and when it's time for you to go. I started zazen practice for two very specific reasons. I wanted everybody to love me, and I wanted to feel happy all the time. At the time, those seemed like entirely realistic expectations. But over time, I've noticed it's pretty interesting. This Zazen practice really hasn't changed much about me. I still experience the same tough physical feelings sometimes, the same soreness, the same stillness, the same need to wiggle. I still have adverse emotions come up, still have thoughts and stories that can be difficult to deal with. What I think is different is just there are times when I notice just a little bit of loosening and a little bit of space between those sensations and emotions and stories and thoughts. It's really in that space and in that loosening that this practice, one, not only offers us freedom, but two, also offers us the opportunity to live this authentic life here and be this real being that we want to be here. So there's a greater stillness that's right here that we can return to. Again, regardless of that, if we're facing that warm sun, that north wind, this authentic heart and this true intention is still here. And we can live it up, right? We can live it up just by doing this practice and trusting that that loosening and that opening will appear on its own. But what's fundamental, though, to this practice and being able to begin this opening to the north wind mind of ours and this opening to the warm sun mind of ours is finding a teacher. And we need a teacher that can help guide us and help support us. I once heard a Zen teacher say that Zazen without a teacher was like Zazen without meditation. And we have a lot of great teachers here that you can connect with, but it doesn't have to be here. You know, I know somebody who considers Thich Nhat Hanh their teacher, even though they never met. Ben Connolly, who many of you know, has written two books, one on Vashu Bandhu, who lived in about the first century AD, and the other one, Setu, who lived in the Middle Ages in China. So these are these two guys who lived thousands of years ago, but I would imagine Ben considers them critical teachers. A teacher doesn't even need to be a Zen practitioner. My grandma and my grandpa, they were great teachers. My grandpa taught me about compassion, and my grandma taught me about wisdom. But as we search for a teacher, it is important that we are a little cautious. You know, we don't want to give away too much to a teacher right away. It's important, as we're seeking out a teacher, that we allow space for trust to grow organically on its own, because we need to be careful. We need to be careful. The teacher-student relationship is a really important one, and we want to be careful and mindful as we step into it. Cool. All right, so that was our first story. That was pretty nice. Felt good to me. Okay, let's transition to our second Aesop fable. And again, this is another one that I was not familiar with, The Hart and the Hunter. So hart is an old English term for deer, but not just any deer, but just really the most majestic deer around. It was the one that noblemen would find be very proud of to have among the deer on their land. So in this story, one of these harts is admiring himself in the waters in the reflection in a pond. He's looking up at his majestic antlers and horns in his reflection. And then he looks down at his feeble legs, which he finds small and ungainly. And then he thinks to himself, I wish I could be as proud of these legs of mine as I am of these antlers. And at that point, a hunter appears. So the hart bounds away, and it's on these thin and feeble legs that allows him to escape, to get away from the hunter. But his majestic horns, they get caught up. They get caught up in a bramble of low-hanging branches. And unfortunately, the hunter comes along and catches the hart. But this being a Buddhist story, he didn't make the hart dinner. They became friends, they hung out. All good. But isn't that true? Where we feel the most comfortable and the most confident sometimes is where we can get the most stuck. Because in this place where we feel comfortable and confident that our ideas about the world, our ideas who we think we should be, who others should be, what the world should be, are most fixed and isolated and disconnected again from this inherent truth that nothing exists apart from anything else. That's why it's Suzuki Roshi said when he said, in the beginner's mind there are many opportunities, but in the expert's mind there are few. And even if you think about experts, be them music performers or top athletes, they need challenge to be able to perform at their peaks. Being in the having a peak experience, which I'm sure a lot of you heard of, scientists, sociologists have studied that peak experiences occur because people's challenges meet skill. There's this moment where challenge meets skill. We have too much challenge, we feel overwhelmed. Too much skill, we're on autopilot. But more importantly, in this practice, it's those places where we feel a little less comfortable. We feel a little less at ease. We feel a little less sturdy on these legs of ours that we can begin to experience loosening and we can experience opening. So it's important that we lean into those places that we don't feel quite as comfortable. We lean into those places where we feel a little more vulnerable, because it's here where we can find these thoughts of ours becoming just a little bit more fluid and a little bit more easy to open up. And I know I've had those experiences myself when if I'm doing something that I don't necessarily feel at ease with, time itself seems to take on a completely different shape. It slows down, it stretches out, it takes on a new weight and a new depth. That's not there when I'm engaged in some rote activity like binge watching Netflix on my couch or something like that. Though that can go way too fast sometimes too, I guess. So one of the fundamental values of this practice is intimacy. You can think of this Zen Center as a lab where we come to experiment with intimacy, or a playground where we play with intimacy. This intimacy is the truth of our experience. It is the truth of this Buddha nature and this awakened heart is here. Discovering it stems from our ability to become intimate with ourselves, intimate with our emotions, intimate with our physical feelings and our stories and our thoughts. And in order to develop ability to be intimate, we need to equally develop an ability to be vulnerable. Brené Brown writes beautifully about vulnerability throughout The Gift of Imperfection, which is a book I'm sure many of you heard about, and it leads me to the quote that's found on your program. Vulnerability is the birthplace of love, belonging, joy, courage, empathy, and creativity. It is the source of hope, empathy, accountability, and authenticity. If we want greater clarity in our purpose or deeper and more meaningful spiritual lives, vulnerability is the path. So as some of you know, I am really lucky that I get to work with an amazing organization that provides programs and services to people who live with an autoimmune neurological disorder. And I become friends with one of our support group leaders, who has led the same support group for over 35 years, and she was actually named the Volunteer of the Year across our nationwide organization 2 years ago, which is a pretty big honor. Her support group has met, and the people in this group have been part of it weekly. They meet in a church in St. Paul, and many of these folks have been in this group not just for years, but for decades. So here they come together, and they provide this deep support just by showing up, by listening, by being open, by expressing their hopes and their fears and their anxieties and their great joys in their life. And they do that because they all share a willingness to be vulnerable, and they all share a willingness to be intimate. I imagine if this group got together and just talked about how awesome their horns were and their antlers were every week, it probably wouldn't last all that long. But it's because they can speak openly and honestly about what's going on inside them, both tough challenges and great opportunities, that they can provide each other with this great, tremendous support and this equally tremendous love, compassion, kindness, and wisdom. So opening to these places where we feel scared, a little less comfortable, too, is where we begin to stir awake what we call in Mahayana Buddhism, bodhicitta, which is literally the heart of a bodhisattva. Bodhicitta is the heart of our bodhisattva practice. Son of Children writes beautifully about bodhicitta here. Sometimes the completely open heart and mind of bodhicitta is called the soft spot, a place as vulnerable and tender as an open wound. Bodhicitta is also equated in part with compassion, our ability to feel the pain that we share with others. Without realizing it, we continually shield ourselves from this pain because it scares us. We put up protective walls made of opinions, prejudices, and strategies, barriers that are built from out of a deep fear of being hurt. These walls are further fortified by emotions of all kinds: anger, craving, indifference, jealousy, envy, arrogance, pride. But fortunately for us, the soft spot, our innate ability to love and to care about things, is like a crack. Like a crack in these walls that we erect. It's a natural opening, and the barriers we create when we're afraid. With practice, we can learn to find this opening. We can learn to seize the vulnerable moment. Love, gratitude, loneliness, embarrassment, and inadequacy to awaken bodhicitta. But to do this, to awaken bodhicitta, lean into our soft spot, experiment with intimacy, experiment with vulnerability, we need to have a safe place to practice. It's really, really important that we find a place where we feel safe and supported and loved and cared for. And it's great if that place is here, the Zen Center. It's one of the reasons why something as simple as sharing and connecting with over tea after we talk is so important. But it doesn't need to be. You know, I imagine people who go to CrossFit gyms, people who go to 12-step groups, people who even just meet up with old friends over coffee find that same kind of safety and that same kind of support that we do here in a traditional sangha. So what I'd like to do now is introduce two folks that I find particularly inspiring in the way that they live their authentic open hearts and live their lives on their legs that may seem at first to be a little unsteady and a little ungainly. And don't worry so much about the majestic horns of theirs. And these two people are Edward D. Wood Jr. and Ringo Starr. So Ed Wood, anybody know Ed Wood, movie fans? Ed Wood is considered nothing less than the worst filmmaker of all time, and he is said to have directed the worst movie of all time, Plan 9 from Outer Space. So Ed Wood's movies feature non-professional actors, cardboard sets, poor special effects like flying saucers hanging from strings, and monsters in shoddy rubber suits. And we love Ed Wood movies because of it, right? Yet if Wood's films weren't simply bad, I doubt people would still feel called to them some 60 years later. There's something else much deeper going on in Ed Wood's films. And I think Roger Ebert, the very famous film critic, said it well when he said Ed Wood is the Will Rogers of filmmaking. He never met a shot he didn't like. So Ed Wood's heart is up there on the screen, completely and fully, regardless of the constraints he had, be it in the time of money, be it in the time of professional actors, or the right equipment, or lack of big name stars. He still just went for it, completely and fully, with foolish abandon, and made movies for the sole fact that he absolutely loved to do it. So while Ed Wood was making films, there was another filmmaker that I want to mention that seems to exist on the opposite end of the spectrum, right? And that's William Wyler, who's a director probably not many people know of today, yet he's one of the most decorated filmmakers of all time. He holds the record for the most number of Academy Award nominations, 12. He made a very famous film the same year Ed Wood made Plan 9 from Outer Space, and I'm sure it's one that a lot of folks here might be familiar with, Ben-Hur, which was a massive critical success in 1959. I won 13 Academy Awards, huge critical acclaim. So here's William Wyler, right? He has everything. He has big marketing campaigns, big stars, all the biggest budget he could want, the right tech, the best technicians, the best artists, the best craftspeople all behind to make his films. Yet today they don't seem to have that same freshness and that same life as Ed Wood's films do, because I think they don't have Ed Wood's heart. They don't have Ed Wood's heart up there on the screen. So I think Ringo Starr is another great example of somebody who just lives his life on his regular old legs and doesn't get too caught up in these big antlers of his big antlers. So of course, you know, when you think of Majestic Antlers, I can't think of many other musical bands that have those as the Beatles. You know, each member of the Beatles seems to take on mythological depth in our culture. I imagine John Lennon's like Manjushri, wielding his sword of wisdom above his head. Paul McCartney's Havalukiteshvara, just taking the world in his warm embrace. George Harrison's like Samant Bhadra, just always knowing the right direction. And Ringo, for me, is like Jizo. He's got a small staff, he just pounds on the ground in order to help protect those small animals as he walks. So Ringo, you know, he's not a very flashy drummer. He's not like Keith Moon or Animal from the Muppets band. He's just Ringo, right? And yet he does exactly what he needs to do to hold the whole band together, to support all those three other guys. So I think Ringo is another wonderful example of living our heart in the hunter practice. Cool. Okay, so let's talk about our third story, The Tortoise and the Hare. I know this is probably one of Aesop's most famous stories, and I think we all know it well, right? Who wins the race? Tortoise. Tortoise wins the race, going slow and steady. This is what Tim Burkett calls turtle practice, and I think it can be equally applicable to living our Bodhisattva vows. So for those of you who might be here at the Zen Center for the first time or just getting familiar with Zen practice, you'll see our Bodhisattva vows right there on the front of your program. Beings are numberless. Regardless, we vow to save them all. Delusions are inexhaustible. Regardless, we vow to exhaust them. Dharma gates are boundless. Regardless, we enter them all. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. Regardless, we become it. And I think for me it's helpful to remember that these Bodhisattva vows of ours aren't so big. Bodhisattva vows of ours aren't so vast because they're so big. But rather they're so vast. They're so endless. They're so constantly unfolding because they're so small. Because they're constantly showing up for us. Each moment at a time. Each breath at a time. Each thought at a time. Each connection at a time. Our Bodhisattva vows are here. Our opportunity to become Buddha, to extinguish the delusion, to enter a Dharma gate, to save all beings is right here over and over again. So just like that tortoise, we meet each moment, one slow, small step at a time, going slow and steady to win the race. But there's no race and there's no winning. So there's a great documentary out there called Spaceline. It used to be on Netflix, and it may still be. It's about a group of engineers, scientists, and inventors who are trying to build an elevator to space. And that sounds like an absolutely preposterous idea. But the theory is you can anchor the elevator at the equator. It would go up 22,000 miles, the geocentric orbit, and gravity would hold the elevator up. And these scientists and engineers are trying to build a cable that would be able to bring materials, people up this elevator. And the thinking is actually this elevator is much cheaper, it's cleaner, and it's much more cost effective than using rocket propulsion. But the big problem is the cable. We don't know how to create a material that's both strong enough and light enough for the elevator, and there's no known material on Earth that can do so. So scientists are trying to create this material. And in the documentary, there's this one engineer who's talking to Neil deGrasse Tyson, the very famous physicist, how excited he is that he's just performed an experiment that he, with a material that he believes won't be able to just reach 22,000 miles, but will be able to extend 62,000 miles. And Neil deGrasse Tyson asked him, well, how much of this cable have you been able to construct before it breaks? And this man exclaims, 150 feet! 150 feet! So this guy is like a tortoise hero of mine, right? He's not so worried about getting to the 22,000 miles or the 62,000 miles. He's just concentrating on the 1 foot in front of him. 148, 149, 150. If it breaks, he just goes right back to 150 again. A more serious and an inspiring example of tortoise practice is the abolition movement in the United Kingdom during the 18th and early 19th century. There's another great book, Adam Hochschild's Bury the Chains. If anybody's interested in social justice, grassroots movements, I just strongly recommend read that book. And it illustrates how all these small grassroots movements fought to end slavery in the biggest empire the world had never known, where the sun literally never set. And in the book, Hochschild talks about how deeply embedded slavery was in the world economic system. And he said, thinking of eliminating slavery with a snap of your fingers would be equal to think of eliminating fossil fuels with a snap of our fingers today, or eliminating all cars immediately today. Yet, on May 22nd, 1787, a small group of just 12 people came together to meet, and they were one of the very first grassroots groups who wanted to fight to bring an end to slavery in the United Kingdom. Just 12 people in the biggest empire in the world on a seemingly unattractable social issue, slavery. Yet by just 5 years later, because they were inspired, not hundreds of grassroots groups made of thousands of people, there were thousands of English people refusing to eat slave-produced sugar. And then by 1830, which is only 53 years later, slavery was completely outlawed across the United Kingdom. And none of that would have began if it wasn't for these 12 people coming together to connect, to have the courage to express and share this great aspiration, this willingness to put in the effort, and the ability to hold loosely to the results. So here's Hochschild speaking well of that first meeting. We can only imagine how the committee members felt as they disappeared to their homes that night. The task they had taken on was so monumental as to have seemed to anyone else impossible. They had to ignite their crusade in a country where the great majority of people, from farmhands to bishops, accepted slavery as completely normal. It was also a country where profits from West Indian plantations gave a large boost to the economy, where custom duties on slavery-grown sugar were important sources of government revenue, and where the livelihoods of tens of thousands of seamen, merchants, and shipbuilders all depended on the slave trade. The trade itself had increased to almost unparalleled levels, bringing prosperity to key ports, including London itself. How even to begin the massive job of changing public opinion? Furthermore, 19 out of 20 Englishmen, and all of English women, of course, were not allowed to vote. Without the most basic rights themselves, could they be roused to care about the rights of other people, of a different skin color, an ocean away? In all of human experience, there was no precedent for such a campaign. So how do we do this keep going? How do we do this keep going, regardless of the times when our aspiration may seem so big, or at times when it may seem impossible? Well, for me, it's really important to know that we have the Dharma. We have the Dharma to rely on. We have our Buddhist teaching to rely on, our Buddhist friends to rely on, our Buddhist teachers to rely on. And I think returning to Buddhist teachings itself to find opportunities to turn that Dharma wheel, to find opportunities for freshness and aliveness for our own practice and our own selves is absolutely vital as we continue on our Bodhisattva journey to realize our Bodhisattva vows. So one place I do find a lot of Dharma actually is YouTube. Before this talk, I watched a YouTube video. It's this great 10-minute documentary in three parts called Tibetan Yoga Masters. And just seeing these old meditation practitioners and this calm British voice narrating the video. Whenever I have times where I might feel a little bit more vulnerable or I feel a little bit more scared to be intimate, I come to this video and I find peace. I find peace just by watching it. And I think YouTube actually has a lot of great stuff. It has guided meditations, it has speakers, it has talks that have nothing to do with Buddhism but can still support our practice, if it's TED Talks, if it's channels like the School of Life, which I think is just a really wonderful channel on personal growth. And then there's always lots and lots of cat videos, plenty of videos that we can turn to. Nothing refreshes me more than watching a bunch of kittens playing a pile of laundry. It's cool. All right. So we discussed three Aesop fables. We discussed the North Wind and the Sun. Talk about how we can begin our Bodhisattva journey by just coming back to right here, this moment here, this life here, regardless of what we may be meeting. We talked about the hunter and the hare, and how we can stir awake bodhicitta by leaning in to those spots where we feel a little bit more vulnerable and have a willingness to be intimate. And then we talked about the tortoise and the hare and realizing our bodhisattva vows just by taking this small step and taking care of this one small thing right in front of us. Cool. So with that, let's turn it over to you guys. I want to hear from you. I'd love to hear your comments, your thoughts, your questions. Anything that's coming up? Oh, go ahead, Ashley.
I think it was interesting with the hare and the hunter in that I was told that sometimes your biggest weakness it can also be your biggest strength.
Yeah, so Ashley.
And I like that, like his legs were the ones that ran with him and the antlers were the ones that most.
Yeah, so Ashley, just for everyone, for those who might be here, we're just commenting that it did seem true that so often, just like with the hunter and the hare, it is our biggest weakness that can be our biggest strength, and vice versa. That it was this thin and ungainly leg that allowed him to escape, and it was his big antlers that got him caught up. I know, when I first read that, I was like, that's a good Zen story. That's going on the list of ones that I'm going to talk about. Yeah, it was really helpful. Christopher.
This one came up, I think, probably, I don't want to take time from other people because I know a lot of you are aware of this one, but one of the big principles that you understand more and more at different levels as you progress in Buddhism is the interconnectedness of life. I think a lot of you are familiar with the story of the Chinese stone cutter. That's a great fable. You know that one?
No, I don't.
Yeah.
You want to tell it, Christopher?
Okay, I'm going to try not to take too long because it's important that the details there. So if you'll forgive me, indulge me for the next, hopefully, less than 5 minutes. There was a stone cutter in ancient China working at the base of a mountain cutting stone for to build temples and places and such, and they did a lot of stone at the time. And he lived for years where all he did all day, every day, was cut stone, and he saw a wealthy landowner one day come by in a parade. And that wealthy landowner had servants and people who did things for him, and he thought, that guy beats me, that guy wins, that guy has life so much better than I ever will. And he made a wish, and he somehow tapped into making magical wishes come true at that moment. And when he woke up the next day, he was a wealthy landowner, and he had servants, and he had land and money and power. And he lived like that for a while, and then one day he had to pay taxes to his king.
Mm.
The king has it made. The king is the winner. Okay, the king's got everything he wants. And he wished then he were the king. He went to the next day and he's the king. and he has all these people paying taxes to him. He has a lot more land, and those landowners now pay him taxes in answer to him. As he was being taken about on a, I don't know what they call them now, where servants carry on four poles. In the ancient Asian world, your servants are doing even carried around on a ship. Thank you. And he got miserably hot being carried around on his poles, laying in his silks, and bothered and humid, and soon he became preoccupied, and this is nothing that crossed his mind when he was a stone cutter. Gee, I'm miserably hot and humid and bothered by the flies and the heat and the sweat of the day. That didn't used to cross his mind. Now that he's king, and all these people answer to him, the heat of the day really bothered him. And he looked at the sun, and he wished he were the sun, because then he would be the ruler. He'd have the power and control. Guess what? He wakes up the next morning. He's the sun. Now, bear in mind, this is the ancient world, so they didn't know about astronomy or the outer world. This is from the viewpoint from the land. And as the sun, he looks down at all these people whose lives he narrates and dictates. They get up in the morning when I tell them to. They go to bed when I tell them to. Their crops grow because my power makes them. And one day he's cut off from that power by the clouds. There's heavy cloud cover. Okay, you guys get the next point. I'm just So he wishes he wore the clouds and the cloud cover because that was had all the control and all the power in the land. Of course, he wakes up the next day and now he's the clouds and he roams about over the earth, blocking the sun. He gets to be between the people and the land and the sun. He has the power and control and he runs into a barrier that he can't get past. It's a mountain range. It's a huge cascading memory. And then he just stops. He can't go anymore. And he realizes that, oh, beyond the sun and the clouds and the king, it's the mountain range. It's there forever. The sun comes and goes. The clouds come and goes. The mountain is there forever. And he becomes the mighty, majestic mountain. He believes he has it all. Now he's the mountain. He wakes up the next morning. And down... Oh, I hear some chuckling. Like he hears something... ticking away and chipping away at his face and who he is.
That stone cutter.
We could take that one back to Narguna. By the way, nobody's ever really said where the emphasis are on the syllables of that philosopher's name.
Narguna and Narguna.
Yeah, we could tie that story back to that guy.
Cool. Thanks, Christopher. That was a good example, though.
On that holster, but by the way, that punchline kind of builds up to itself. But it's a good story to tell to children to give them perspective.
Absolutely. You're a good storyteller.
Well, thank you. I'm trying to think that.
You did a great job.
By the way, I'm going to give everybody here my age a little bit of a chuckle. The first time I heard that story was on a TV show called Kung Fu. if you haven't heard of Kung Fu, don't look it up. It was what we thought. Some people thought Buddhism was in the early 70s.
It's still good.
People ended up meeting real roshis and going to real temples because of that, or because they heard Alan Watts talk. Things like that. I had to look at 10 when I brought up Alan Watts.
Thank you. Do we have any kind of questions or comments?
It's actually on Amazon Prime now. Okay. I've been watching it.
That's where I heard the story of the stone cutter. I found out that story had been around for centuries.
Maybe we can shoot for any non-Kung Fu related. Or if people want to talk about Kung Fu, we can do that too.
Actually, little stories about it.
Yeah, I agree. Cool. Anything else?
Just your comment on Ringo Starr. There was a point Beatles, when they were breaking, that they're producing, I believe it's George Martin, but I may be wrong, realized that Ringo Starr wasn't the best technical drummer, and he offered to them, hey, we can get anybody. And they all chose him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's a great story. Cool. Marker?
Oh, I was just thinking this is such a good story, the Tortoise and the Hare. Yeah. Story for our times, because I frequently just find myself sitting in front of the TV so frustrated.
Yeah.
And thank God, you know, I have this practice because I think it does slow you down and make you practice the awareness.
Absolutely.
And it's not going to change all of America's life. It can change by tomorrow. It's not. Mm-hmm. That story with the abolitionist was a great story, too.
Which looks like someone
least,
else.
At
someone
least the English didn't have to have a civil war over the abolitionists.
Did anybody else have a comment or thought? Go ahead.
Raul.
Hey, Raul.
Hey. I was trying to find some motivation. I'm going to share the stories that you shared, but over the last 14 months, specifically this year, there's been a lot of change in my life. And there were times where I was questioning not necessarily why I'm here, but what I'm striving, where I'm striving to go internally and then extrinsically. And that still hasn't been answered yet. However, I've been taking things as a blank slate in my life for the most part, and starting over. And learning more to just slow it down, and I don't have to be the hare, I guess. I can be more of the tortoise and letting things fall into place by not forcing things to help it. I have a lot of gratitude for where I'm at actually right now today, because I have time to where I can engage in my personal care and my self-care, and being able to come to a Dharma talk on a Sunday morning, and to work on a Sunday morning, or certain evenings of the week, that I'm free, and I'm going to take advantage of that while I can, while I'm not burdened, so to speak, by a lot of financial responsibilities or means to cover financial working. Also known as working a lot, which I've done in the past, and has kind of separated myself from my spirituality. So, that's what I have today. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Thank you.
Well, thanks for sharing.